From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting live from Copenhagen. This is Climate Countdown.
This text is an extremely dangerous document for developing countries. It is a total violation of the principles of transparency and openness.
Uproar at the climate change talks here in Copenhagen. Developing nations are reacting furiously to news that the United States, Britain, and Denmark have drafted a secret climate deal that hands more power to wealthy nations and sidelines the role of the United Nations. Under the draft text, rich countries would be permitted to emit nearly twice as much as those in poor countries. We'll speak with journalist Naomi Klein, Martin Kaur of South Center, and the chief climate negotiator for Bolivia and Paraguay. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from Copenhagen. Global climate talks here in Copenhagen have been shaken up with the news wealthy nations have drafted a secret agreement sidelining poorer countries and the United Nations. On Tuesday, The Guardian newspaper published details of a leaked agreement said to include the U.S., Britain, Denmark, and a handful of others. The deal lacks binding emissions cuts and would allow rich countries to pollute nearly twice as much as poorer nations by 2050. After the document was revealed, dozens of African observers at the summit staged a protest inside the conference halls. The Sudanese negotiator, Lumumba Stanislas Diaping, chair of the Group of 77 bloc of developing nations, said the proposals are unacceptable.
G77 member states will not walk out of these consultations or negotiations in this late hour, because we cannot afford failure of Copenhagen. And let me just actually be very blunt. $10 billion will not buy developing countries' people enough coffins.
We'll have more from here inside the Copenhagen summit after headlines. Senate Democrats appear to have finalized a deal on removing a government-funded public insurance option from their health care reform bill. On Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said a group of 10 Democrats had reached broad agreement on a so-called compromise proposal. The plan would abandon a government-funded health plan to compete with private insurers. Instead, the Federal Office of Personnel Management would hire the insurance companies to run the health plans. Uninsured Americans between the age of 55 and 64 would also be able to obtain coverage through Medicare. Reid says he'll unveil the plan after the Congressional Budget Office analyzes its costs. The announcement came as the Senate defeated an amendment that would have added harsh anti-abortion restrictions to the health care bill. The proposal from Democratic Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska mirrored language in the House bill that bars any woman who receives government health insurance subsidies from enrolling in an insurance plan covering abortion. The amendment failed by a margin of 54 to 45. After the vote, Nelson said he's unlikely to support the final health care reform bill with his amendment removed. As the Senate health care effort continues, single-payer advocates are planning a national day of action. That's Thursday at Senate offices nationwide. The group Mobilization for Health Care for All says it'll hold sit-ins at Senate offices in 18 cities. The sit-ins are timed to coincide with International Human Rights Day, which marks the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. The declaration affirms medical care as a basic human right. A new study of health care in wealthy nations, meanwhile, says the U.S. ranks near the bottom in life expectancy, despite spending more than double the average amount in health care costs. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says U.S. health care spending averaged over $7,000 in 2007, nearly 2.5 times the OECD average. Life expectancy was 78.1 years, putting the U.S. in 26th place out of 30 member nations. The Obama administration's reached a settlement in a long-running class action lawsuit over federal mismanagement of Native American and trusts dating back to the 19th century. On Tuesday, the Interior Department announced it would pay $3.4 billion to settle claims by more than 300,000 Native Americans for unpaid royalties on seized lands. The settlement is a fraction of the estimated $176 billion Native Americans have maintained they're owed. On Tuesday, the lead plaintiff in the suit, Eloise Cobell of the Blackfeet Nation in Montana, said it was time to reach a compromise.
Although we have reached a settlement totaling more than $3.4 billion, there is little doubt this is significantly less than the full accounting to which individual Indians are entitled. Yes, we could prolong our struggle and fight longer, and perhaps one day we would know down to the penny how much individual Indians are owed. Perhaps we could even litigate long enough to increase the settlement amount. But we are compelled to settle now by the sobering realization that our class grows smaller each year, each month, and every day as our elders die and are forever prevented from receiving their just compensation.
$3.4 billion is the largest amount Native Americans have received from the federal government to date, eclipsing all previous settlements combined. President Obama has unveiled a new round of economic stimulus proposals to address unemployment. On Tuesday, Obama called for business tax cuts, infrastructure spending, and a Cash for Calkers program that would provide incentives for home weatherization. Obama said an anticipated lower cost of the Wall Street bailout could help fund his plan.
TARP is expected to cost the taxpayers at least $200 billion less than what was anticipated just this past summer. And the assistance to banks, once thought to cost taxpayers untold billions, is on track to actually reap billions in profits for the taxpaying public. So this gives us a chance to pay down the deficit faster than we thought possible, and to shift funds that would have gone to help the banks on Wall Street to help create jobs on Main Street.
Toll from Tuesday's multiple bombings in Baghdad has reached at least 127. More than 500 people were also wounded in what was one of the worst attacks to hit Iraq this year. At the United Nations, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned the bombings.
I'm very shocked, and I condemn in the strongest terms possible. This just unacceptable, the horrendous terrorist bombing against the civilians. This must be stopped.
Oh, good. Okay. As Iraqi civilians continue to endure deadly attacks, the U.S. and British pre-war effort to justify the invasion and occupation of Iraq is coming under new scrutiny. A British parliamentarian is now claiming the U.S. and Britain based one of its claims about Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction on the hearsay testimony of an Iraqi taxi driver. The taxi driver is said to have recounted a conversation he claimed to have overheard between Iraqi officials 2 years earlier. Citing British intelligence officials, the parliamentarian, Adam Holloway, says the taxi driver's claims became the basis for U.S. and British intelligence that Saddam Hussein could deploy chemical or biological weapons within 45 minutes. The Obama administration's two top military and civilian officials in Afghanistan appeared on Capitol Hill Tuesday to make the case for President Obama's escalation of the Afghan occupation and war. It was the first congressional appearance by General Stanley McChrystal and Ambassador Carl Eikenberry since Obama announced the deployment of at least 30,000 additional troops last week. A protester with the group Code Pink was removed from the hearing after holding up a sign reading, "Surge, big mistake." Eikenberry, meanwhile, addressed the controversy over his reported opposition to deploying additional troops, saying he, in fact, supported the escalation all along.
It was not a question of additional troops. It was the question, as we all had, about the number of troops. What would be the timelines for those troops? What would be the context that those troops would operate in? With that, at this point in time, as I said in my opening statement, Mr. Chairman, I am unequivocally in support of this mission, and I am exactly aligned with General McChrystal here to my right in moving forward now to vigorously implement the assigned mission.
It will cut ties with a scandal-plagued private military firm hired to guard the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan. The firm, Armor Group America, came under scrutiny this year after 12 guards made claims of unauthorized armed missions, security lapses, and lewd behavior. The State Department says Armor Group's contract won't be renewed when it expires next summer. Japan says it suspended talks with the Obama administration over relocating a U.S. military airbase. The Japanese government has said it wants to move the base completely off the island of Okinawa, while the U.S. wants to maintain a base somewhere else on the island. Tens of thousands of Okinawa residents have taken part in ongoing protests against the base. In Honduras, the winner of last month's controversial national election says he wants full political amnesty for all those involved in the coup that overthrew Honduran President Manuel Zelaya last June. On Tuesday, Porfirio Lobo told reporters, quote, there must be an amnesty for all. His comments came as the Mercosur grouping of South American nations, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay, issued a declaration along with Venezuela condemning Lobo's victory as illegal. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez criticized the U.S. for backing off its stated commitment to restoring Zelaya to office.
Obama said that he had come to talk about the future, that he didn't want to talk about the past. But he is supporting the past. He is supporting the past without any form of shame. And following him, sadly and unfortunately, is a group of governments from our own America.
In Brazil, a new report says police have killed at least 11,000 people since 2003. The Human Rights Watch study focused on Brazil's two largest metropolitan areas, Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo. Researchers say they uncovered evidence of police covering up dozens of extrajudicial killings. The Obama administration's asked an appeals court to dismiss a torture lawsuit against former Bush administration lawyer John Yoo. The former so-called enemy combatant Jose Padilla is suing Yoo for devising the legal justification for his imprisonment and torture. Padilla was jailed for 43 months without charge in a Navy brig in South Carolina and is now serving a 17-year sentence. In a court filing, the Obama administration says federal laws prevent damage claims against lawyers who advise the president on national security. And in Massachusetts, State Attorney General Martha Coakley has won the Democratic nomination to run for the late Edward Kennedy Senate seat. Coakley will square off against the Republican nominee, State Senator Scott Brown, in a special election next month. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting live from Copenhagen. This is Climate Countdown.
Time is up. Over the next 2 weeks, governments have to deliver a strong and long-term response to the challenge of climate change.
All those countries are suffering to the point that we can't see the end of it because the mistakes other countries are making. For the mistakes that that many people don't try to redeem themselves from. And
this is Climate Countdown. We're broadcasting live from Copenhagen. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now!'s Anjali Kamat.
Welcome, everyone. We're here in the Bello Center in Copenhagen. The UN talks here are in disarray after developing countries reacted furiously to leaked documents that show world leaders next week will be asked to sign an agreement that hands more power to rich countries and sidelines the UN's role in all future climate change negotiations. The secret draft agreement was leaked to the Guardian newspaper, which broke the story yesterday afternoon. The document also sets unequal limits on per capita carbon emissions for developed and developing countries in 2050, meaning that people in rich countries would be permitted to emit nearly twice as much as those in poor countries. The Guardian reports the document, known as the Danish text, was worked on by a group of individuals known as the Circle of Commitment. It is understood to include Britain, the United States, and Denmark, and has only been shown to a handful of countries since it was finalized this week. The head of the UN climate talks, Ivo de Boer, downplayed the significance of the leaked document, saying, quote, this was an informal paper ahead of the conference given to a number of people for the purposes of consultations. The only formal texts in the UN process are the ones tabled by the chairs of this Copenhagen conference at the behest of the parties. Moments before we went on the air, Lumumba Stanislas Diaping addressed the controversy. He is the Sudanese chair of the group of 132 developing countries known as G77 in China.
Is that this text, the Danish text, is an extremely dangerous document for developing countries. It is a total violation of the principles of transparency and openness. It is a rejection of the fact that the UNFCCC is the only legitimate forum for conducting negotiations by parties to the convention. And in terms of substance, it is a fundamental rejection and reworking of the UNFCCC balance of obligations between developing and developed countries. Not only that, it's our humble view, it's equally an insult to the elected president of COP15. This text comes from the office of the Prime Minister of Denmark. Its overreaching strategic goal is to destroy the balance of obligations between developing and developed industrialized Western countries. And this is done by and with a zealous rejection of the notion of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. And further, it denies the fact that developed countries have a historical responsibility for damaging the atmospheric space, which is something started and has been continuing for the last, over the last 200 years.
Lumumba Stanislas Diaping addressing the controversy of the so-called Danish text. We're joined here in Copenhagen at the Bella Center by two people. Martin Kors, executive director of the South Center, journalist. Also, Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! You've been watching this carefully. We're going to go back to the Sudanese delegate talking, responding to this so-called secret Danish text. Martin Kors, explain further.
I think we all have been told that there is no plan B for Copenhagen and that we have to work very hard, you know, on the documents on the table. So the fact that we have this 10-page document shows that they have been working on a plan B. And most of the developing countries that I have spoken to do not know at all about this text. So they feel shortchanged in that they had no say they were not invited to contribute to a text that may be parachuted down on them later on this week by the ministers or by the presidents, and they would not have had enough time to look at it. So the process is what is bothering many, but also the substance, because the text calls for a 50% cut in global emissions by 2050, and it says that the developed countries are willing to cut by 80%. So my calculations show that if this is being proposed, the developing countries would have to cut their emissions by at least 60% per capita, or about the same as the developed countries. And that will bring their per capita emissions of greenhouse gases to about 2 tons per person by 2050, whereas a country like the United States, which now has 20 tons per capita, would go down to about 4 tons. So this means that the U.S. would still be able to have double the per capita emissions that poor developing countries have in 2050, when the United States is so superior in terms of income, in technology, and they have contributed so much, you know, to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So this is what is outraging the developing countries.
And Martin, what do you think developing countries are going to do? Do you suspect that there'll be a walkout? What is the next step?
I don't think there will be a walkout, but they would now, I think, in fact, they should now come out with their own text, you know, to say that this is our position on what we see as the Copenhagen decision and not something that somebody else is putting for us. I think the other major issue for the developing countries is that this text implies the closure of the Kyoto Protocol. And that's something that all the developing countries are united against, because the Kyoto Protocol is the legally binding international agreement. The only country not in it is the United States.
Naomi Klein, let's go on from what Martin Kaur is saying. The issue of the Kyoto Protocol in the United States is always talking about it sunsets, it ends in 2012. Mm-hmm. But that's not true.
It's one of the great misconceptions, and I actually didn't fully understand it until Martin explained it to me. So he probably can explain it much better than I can. But there is no expiration date on the Kyoto Protocol. What it had was a first period of emissions cuts that ends in 2012. And the idea was that countries would come back together and increase their emission cuts and develop the agreement. But the idea that it just needs to be scrapped completely and replaced with a wholly new deal, and that in addition to this, there isn't time to come up with a whole new deal, which is the position of the U.S. negotiators here, is based on this faulty premise that the Kyoto Protocol expires. But I think, you know, the real issue here is what they want to replace the Kyoto Protocol with is much weaker than the Kyoto Protocol. They want to—the Kyoto Protocol comes up with a goal for all the countries that they have to reach in terms of emissions cuts, and it's legally binding. Here, what they want to replace it to is all countries go off, come up with their own goals, and then it's sort of mashed together into an agreement that really isn't a multilateral agreement, because the whole idea of multilateralism is that countries agree on the same set of rules, and they agree to a common monitoring mechanism. So the great irony of what's happening here in Copenhagen is that it takes place in this context of this huge global celebration of the U.S. re-embrace of multilateralism. In fact, Obama is getting the Nobel Prize specifically for this. In the citation for the Nobel Prize, they talk about the re-engagement with the climate talks, the embrace of multilateralism. He's getting the Nobel Prize for it. But what's actually happening here is that they're using the tools of multilateralism, the infrastructure of multilateralism, to destroy multilateralism, to kill multilateralism.
We're going to break, then we're going to come back to this discussion. Naomi Klein, well-known journalist, author of The Shock Doctrine, and the 10th anniversary edition is just out of her first book, No Logo. Martin Kaur with us, executive director of the South Center. We're live in Copenhagen. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with them. Then we'll be joined by the chief climate change negotiators from two Latin American countries, from Paraguay and Bolivia. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. It is Climate Countdown. We're live in Copenhagen at the Bella Center, the only global daily news hour, broadcasting on television, radio, and the internet from right here at the Climate Talks at COP15, the Conference of Parties. Our two guests right now are Naomi Klein. She's blogging for The Nation magazine, and she is author of The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. Martin Kaur is with us as well. He's executive director of the South Center. He's based in Geneva, comes from Malaysia. And then we'll be joined by the chief climate negotiators from two Latin American countries, from Paraguay and Bolivia. I'm Amy Goodman with Anjali Kamat. Anjali?
Martin, can you talk about some of the numbers in the Danish text, the text produced by the Circle of Commitment? They talk about $10 billion to be invested in this.
$10 billion for developing countries to take all these actions to prevent climate change and to tackle the effects of climate change is too minuscule. You know, the United Nations recently—
That's $10 billion a year.
$10 billion a year. But the UN estimated that you require at least $500 to $600 billion a year, and a new study in London shows that you need at least $500 billion a year. In fact, in my estimation, we need at least 2% of the GNP of the rich countries, and that's about $800 billion a year.
What does it pay for?
You see, you have to allow the developing countries to continue their economic growth and at the same time to reduce their emissions. The only way in which they can do this is if we have massive transfers of finance and technology, you know, not for luxuries, but simply to get food production and housing and, you know, to build the seawalls and so on. If this amount of money does not come, then the developing countries are sunk or fried by climate change. And they won't be able to take their own actions in terms of changing their technology in transportation, in energy, in industry, and so on.
I think one of the things that's so important about this is that everybody we all have a vested interest in this. It's not—first of all, it's not charity. It is based on the principle that the polluter pays, that the rich world created the climate crisis. So it isn't a handout. But in addition to it not being a handout, as Martin says, everybody in the world has an interest in helping the developing world to leapfrog over fossil fuels and develop using cleaner but more expensive technologies, more expensive upfront, because the technologies are expensive at the start. Eventually, they actually become cheaper than fossil fuels. But there is a heavy upfront cost, and that's what these numbers would be covering in part.
And can you talk a little bit about the issues around the transfer of technology and how it ties into trade agreements and intellectual property rights?
Well, the thing is that technology will be required if we are to change from, you know, the old patterns of energy in developing countries, and that causes trillions of dollars of cash, you know, and then all the machines in the industries, all the motor cars that are outmoded and so on, they have to be totally refitted and rechanged. But for us to be able to obtain the technology to do this, it has to be at the cheapest possible cost, because each dollar of technology that we have must be able to do five times the work, because it's five times cheaper. And so we come to this issue of intellectual property rights. When intellectual property rights attached to a technology becomes a barrier to its transfer, because it increases the costs and it prevents developing countries from making the same technologies, then we have to overcome this barrier in order to have the greater international global good. And this is one of the issues being discussed here. Unfortunately, the developed countries seem to want to maintain their total control over intellectual property, which means technological dominance over such a crucial area as climate change. But the talks are still going on, and we hope that the United States in particular will relax their very rigid stand that we will have business as usual on intellectual property, whilst we ask you not to have business as usual in terms of your pattern of development.
I want to ask a question about, well, for example, very powerful statement of the representative of the Group of 77 in China, Stanislav, Lumumba Stanislas Diaping of Sudan. The representatives here, for example, of Sudan, I mean, will be discredited by many right away, saying, who is he to? I mean, it was a powerful statement about imperialism, that this is a disgrace, that this secret Danish text is actually dangerous right now, that it's a new Bretton Woods.
I think the outrage really is that we were told all along there's no such text, there's no plan B. We are not having a small group of people cooking up something. So when it is revealed by a newspaper that indeed there is a plan B, you know, and that a few people have been looking at it, then those who are excluded feel very discouraged, because this is the United Nations. It's a very democratic forum. People put forward their proposals. We fight and quarrel, but at the end of the day, we reach an agreement. So I think the feeling is that there should not have been an exclusive group. Right. And if there is a plan to come out with a short version of a declaration, then each region should have been asked to have a representative, and that we thresh it out together.
But that issue of the human rights abusers being the spokespeople, like the country of Sudan.
Well, Sudan does not speak for itself in terms of the group of 77. It is there to represent the entire group. This is an association of developing countries. And what he says is to represent the feelings of the 130 countries of the group of 77. So he has that mandate to represent the views of these countries. It is not his personal view.
I think it is really important, though, Amy, that you raise it, because we have to understand that this is part of a pattern, that whenever things happen at the UN that the U.S. and other powerful players don't like, the strategy in order to discredit the policies, no matter how many developing countries back it, is to single out a couple of governments with well-earned bad reputations and say, well, we don't need to be, if we think about the Durban 2 conference, for instance, the Durban Review conference, what was the line? It was, we don't want to hear about racism from Libya and Sudan, never mind that there were 18 countries that were on the planning committee. So this will be, I think, one of the lines of attack against the fact that the Africa group, as well as the G77, has been very, very strong throughout these negotiations. And we talked about it before, about how the African group negotiating bloc walked out of the negotiations in Barcelona. So, you know, when you start to lose political ground, you start to take other lines of attack. And this is certainly going to be one of them. The other one is to claim that there's no big deal about this text. Everyone knew about it. That's also not true. I interviewed Bernadita Smuler, who's from the Philippines and is really the chief negotiator for the G77. She said that this was the first time that she had heard of the text was when she read about it in The Guardian. And she also said that she's been part of these negotiations since 1988. And that she's never seen anything like this. So this is quite unprecedented. And these attempts to downplay it are, once again, you know, political lines, because they got caught.
President Obama will be getting the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo tomorrow. He will be addressing the escalation of war in Afghanistan, receiving the Peace Prize as he announces the escalation of war. Naomi Klein, your response to this and how the United States fits into this Danish text and President Obama coming here next week, agreeing to come at the end, not at the beginning.
Well, you know, on the one hand, it's encouraging that he's coming at the end. On the other hand, we have to understand how politics works, and I think probably this text, the existence of this text, has something to do with why Obama agreed to come to the end. I mean, most people here have observed that Obama wouldn't come unless there had been some sort of a guarantee of an outcome that would have been acceptable to the United States, and clearly they thought this Danish text was going to be adopted. But you know, if we think about Afghanistan, even, you know, coming back to the headlines that you read earlier about Zelaya, you know, 1 year into the Obama administration, I think that we're seeing on so many of the key issues that we really believed there would be change, or where change was promised, that there was a new era of relationships with Latin America, that there was going to be a much less aggressive stand when it comes to the military, the financial sector, and now climate change. We're seeing a series of very profound betrayals, and this is one piece of it, but a major piece of it.
Martin Kaur, on that same issue.
I think that the U.S. has a positive role to play in the climate negotiations, which it has yet to play, by allowing those countries who are in the Kyoto Protocol, and that's all the developed countries except the U.S., to remain there and to take their commitments there and to take high commitments there to reduce their emissions by at least 40%. And the United States, even if it does not want to join the protocol for whatever reason, can take a similar commitment inside the convention, because the U.S. is a member of that convention, and do a similar commitment, do a similar cut. Now, the reverse is happening, as we have seen in the Danish tax, that those developed countries in the Kyoto Protocol with high commitments are on the verge of jumping ship to join the United States, where the U.S. is not willing to commit to an international treaty at the moment, and is giving a very low commitment figure of reducing its emissions by about 4% between 1990 and 2020. When the sign says that we have to do it by at least 25% to 40%, preferably 40%, and Europe is willing to do 30%. So it looks as if the other countries are watching the United States and saying that if the U.S. is going to do so little and is not going to be internationally legally bound, then we are all going to follow the United States in a race, if not to the bottom, to very near the bottom. And this is what is at the heart of the crisis in the negotiation. So if Mr. Obama comes and he can, even if he cannot join the Kyoto Protocol, and we understand why, he could urge the other countries not to jump ship to the U.S., because one day the U.S. is willing to jump up to their standard, and they can just wait for the U.S. for another 5 years.
Obama needs to hear this from the people who voted him in part because they felt that there was going to be a new era on the environment. The Kyoto Protocol is not dying. It's being killed here in Copenhagen, and Obama needs to hear from his constituents that they don't want it to die.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Naomi Klein, author, blogger here for The Nation magazine, and author of The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. Martin Kaur is executive director of the South Center. He's based in Geneva. He's from Malaysia. This is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting live from the Bella Center from COP15, the climate change conference, the only daily global TV radio news hour that is broadcasting from inside and bringing you voices from the outside as well. A group of international climate justice activists have entered day 34 of a hunger strike. The strike began on November 6th, the final day of the Barcelona climate talks. On Tuesday, Democracy Now! Producer Mike Burke spoke with one of the hunger strikers here at the climate summit in Copenhagen.
My name's Anna Keenan. I'm from Australia, but I've been living in Europe for the last year, and I had my 24th birthday on day 10 of the hunger strike, and now it's day 33 of Climate Justice Fast, so I haven't eaten in over a month. And I'm undertaking this action because I feel that as an activist for the last 3 or 4 years, I've done all sorts of different campaigning. I've written petitions, I've signed letters, I've lobbied governments. I've got arrested on top of a coal train in civil disobedience, and I feel like politics just is not changing fast enough, so we need to take our activism to a higher and more moral level. And that's why I've decided that, inspired by Gandhi and Martin Luther King, that I've decided to take on this hunger strike.
How long are you going to continue the strike?
We're not yet sure under what conditions the hunger strike is going to end. It depends a lot what happens here at the negotiations over the next 2 weeks. The only guarantee that we can really offer is that if we see the huge shift towards climate justice that we need, if we see the political paradigm shift and the cultural paradigm shift emerging from COP15, then we will confidently conclude our hunger strike. But other than that, we're not sure under what conditions the strike will end.
And what does climate justice mean to you?
Climate justice is a very complex term. You'll actually see, if you have a look at the back of my neck here, I've got it tattooed on my neck. So climate justice to me means a multitude of things. Basically, justice to anybody means that whoever has committed an injustice must be changed and brought to justice. So to me, that means the end of fossil fuels. All of the companies and nations that have profited so much from using fossil fuels and from deforesting the earth over the last 30 years must be changed. You know, those practices have to end immediately. And then the other side of justice is that those who have been committed an injustice against must be, you know, that they have to be compensated and that has to be made right. So to those people who are in the most affected nations, they need to be paid compensation for adaptation. You know, they're suffering the effects of a problem they didn't cause. And we've profited from that in the developed world, so we need to be paying them very directly to compensate them. And we're calling for at least $195 billion per year. And that's to cover adaptation, to help them to develop in a zero-carbon way, to end deforestation, and to help convert agriculture into sustainable agriculture.
And can you say a few words about how climate change has impacted Australia?
Absolutely. Climate change has had a horrific effect on our country already, and if it continues, it's going to be absolutely disastrous. The Murray-Darling Basin, which is the food bowl of Australia, is where 2 million people make their livelihoods farming, and the rivers are drying out. The droughts are taking the water straight out of the river systems. There's rising salinity. Like the farming communities who are there have seen suicide rates skyrocket because they're not able to financially sustain themselves anymore. And Australia could be going from being a net food producing and exporting country to needing to become a food importer. Aside from that, we've seen devastating bushfires. They're wiping out, you know, towns and communities. We've seen cattle dying. At the same time as we've seen bushfires in the south, the exact same time we've seen floods in the north, in Queensland, in my state. It's insane. Like, you know, Australia's always been a country of, you know, contrasting climates, but never to the extent that we've seen now. And to think that this could go on, you know, and get worse over the next 50 years, you know, is a really scary prospect for me.
That was Australian climate activist Anna Keenan. She's now in the 34th day of a hunger strike. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. It's Climate Countdown. We're live from Copenhagen. When we come back, the chief negotiators, the chief climate change negotiators for two Latin American countries, Paraguay and Bolivia. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, and that was Angelique Kidjo, who came to Copenhagen for the UN Climate Summit. I'm Amy Goodman with Angelique Comet, as we continue with the voices inside and out, outside of the Bella Center, where this convention summit is taking place of well over 15,000 people, in fact, including the journalists, it's over 20,000, Angelique.
Well, the UN summit here in Copenhagen saw one of its first protests Tuesday when members of the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance marched inside the conference center, citing the scientific evidence that the planet's average temperature could rise by more than 2 degrees Celsius. The protesters chanted, 2 degrees is suicide.
Actually, it is one of the disappointments, and we have been following very keenly, and we have realized that particularly the Danish Prime Minister is determined to deliver a politically binding deal, which, of course, you know, there is no deal there. It is just something, a decoration of a failure. So we are determined to ensure that if they don't deliver a fair deal, and that is a legally binding deal, under the pillars of what we have been negotiating. Then we want to add the African group, the G77, and even the heads of states and ministers will be coming, that it is dangerous. They should not sign a genocide paper for us.
The developed countries that do not want to sign reasonable commitments under these negotiations. So we are not saying we want to work out. We will not want our negotiators to work out. But please don't force them to do so, because Africa is too hot for us, and we don't want people to continue to take advantage of us.
Augustine Nyamshi from Cameroon, voices from inside the Bella Center. Well, we go now to the chief climate negotiators from both Bolivia and Paraguay. Bolivia has been one of the countries leading the call for just climate reparations here at the COP15 talks. President Evo Morales, who was just re-elected in a landslide victory, has been outspoken on the issue of climate debt. He told Mother Jones magazine last November, quote, "If there are countries that are doing a lot of damage to the environment, those countries should make some acknowledgement, some reparation for the damages that they are causing." Soon after, he released a sweeping 20-point plan, including a demand that developed countries contribute a minimum of 1% of their annual GDP to a United Nations fund for poor countries. We're joined now by Angelica Navarro, the chief climate negotiator for Bolivia, and we're also joined by Miguel Lovera, the chief negotiator for Paraguay. He's played a key role in negotiations over the world's rainforests that many expect will be one of the few deals to be actually finalized at the summit here in Copenhagen. It's called RED, or Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation, and a final text is expected as early as this weekend. Angelico Navarro and Miguel Lovera, welcome both of you to Democracy Now! Angelica, maybe we can start with you. Talk about the Danish text and your reaction.
Well, I have to say that everybody was taken a little bit by surprise, but I also want to congratulate the very good work that the press has been doing, because we have learned it from the press, actually. And the reaction has been quite straightforward from the G77, and in two accounts, on process and on the content. And on the process, I have to say that we are quite surprised, because this is not what we were expecting. 192 countries are united here to try to come to a deal. And there is this parallel process that basically seems to be untransparent, undemocratic, non-participatory, top-down, that it seems to be imposing itself on what we are trying to achieve with 192 countries. We think that we have to come back to the real track, and that is a track with participation, inclusiveness, and democracy. That is for the process. But in the content, we have serious also concerns on the content. It seems that we are talking about just one agreement, disregarding the two tracks, two mandates, and two results that we are trying to achieve here in Copenhagen. I want to remind everybody that G77 and Bolivia, African Group, and other groups have been calling very strongly to have the Kyoto Protocol survive. That is, that developed countries should come with their second commitment period, ambitious numbers for the reductions of emissions. That is one of the results we want from here. The second result that we want is, of course, an enhanced implementation of the convention through the LCA process. What the Danish text seems to be doing is a merge of the two, which impose new obligations to developing countries. So we are the ones that are supposed now to be mitigating. And I'm asking, what will a developing country, rural men or women, indigenous women in Bolivia, doesn't even have electricity, will mitigate? And for what? So that developed countries can even have still two, three cars? Or just like four times a change of their clothes in a year? What are they asking? Do they want us to finance the problems they are causing? Why should I pay for them? But on top of that, why should we choose between building a school, a bridge, or a hospital and adapt? So that is what we think. And on top of that, we think that the level of ambition that what is proposed in the Danish leaked text is definitely not enough. It will not solve the problem. It will not solve the climate change.
Angelica Navarro, you took the stage by storm, to use a climate metaphor, in June in Bonn, Germany, when you talked about this issue of climate debt. Explain what you mean by it.
I just want to remind that actually historical responsibility is already in the convention, and we were, if I'm not mistaken, five countries that presented in Bonn, in a technical briefing, a historical responsibility quantification of what developed countries have done and what they should do as a result. That was India, Brazil, China, and Bolivia. The Bolivian proposal in specific is climate debt. What do I mean, and what does Bolivia mean by that? Is basically that developed countries have overconsumed the atmospheric, common atmospheric space. 20% of the population have actually emitted more than two-thirds of the emissions, and as a result, they have caused more than 90% of the increase in temperatures. As a result, developing countries, we are suffering. Bolivia's glaciers are melting between 40 to 55%. We have extended droughts. We are having the lowlands more flooding, and we are losing between 4 to 17% of our GDP in the worst years. That is climate debt. And what we are asking is repayment. We are not asking for aid. We are not asking, we are not begging for aid. We want developed countries to comply with their obligation and pay their debt. How are they going to pay it? The first part is to pay it through reduction emission domestically. They have really to fulfill their obligations. This is not money. This is not the part of monetary. They just have to comply with their obligations ambitiously for the first and second commitment period. And the second part of the climate debt is the adaptation debt. Everything that we are already suffering as Bolivia, as indigenous people in Africa and in other parts, that we can accept that is finance and transfer of technology, but not the peanuts that we are seeing on the table right now. That is not even a fraction of what they have used to save their bank. But apparently, finance and banks are more important than people and life. And that is very sad, but it's like that. Because we think that they are negotiating not an environmental agreement, they seem to be negotiating an economic agreement.
Evo Morales, your president, is calling for a 49% cut in greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes. Actually, we have several numbers. We are asking for the 49%, and I'm happy to be with Paraguay because we are co-sponsoring the same, actually, submission. This 49% has to be in 2017. But even like that, developed countries will not be able to repay their debt. They have to pay more. We know they cannot do that, but the amount is so important that actually developed countries should do negative cuts. How are they going to do that? We have to think about it. When the 49% is just a fraction of what they are doing. Meaning that they have to reduce everything to zero, but on top of that, they have to liberate atmospheric space they have occupied unrightfully for developing countries to develop. What they cannot pay in emission cuts, they can pay a little bit on finance and transfer of technology. We can think on that. And of course, we have to go real on the numbers. It's not only the cuts, but it's also the degrees that we want to talk about. We are talking less than 1% as Bolivia, because 2% is the reality of the north. 2% is 3% for Africa or for the south. You have to add at least 1 degree to what developed countries are proposing. Let's get real on the reality of the south has come, and it has to come in numbers.
Speaking of numbers, I want to go to Miguel Dovera, the delegate from Paraguay. Can you talk about RED? There's been a lot of emphasis on how there's going to be a final deal on RED achieved in Copenhagen, and it's being touted as the only way to save the world's rainforests. What are your concerns about RED? How does financing work within RED, and where do the emission cuts come from?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I guess the only thing we agree with the rest of the crowd here is that stopping deforestation is the only way to save the forests. That's basically it. But then how do you do that we definitely disagree with the proposals. And especially, we don't want to submit our forests to a mechanism that will transform them into mere carbon stocks.
Can you explain what that means?
That means that our forests are much more a guarantee to life on Earth, to life cycles on Earth, to the carbon cycle. Definitely, they're the greatest terrestrial reservoirs of carbon, but they are also home to more than 90% of the species that live on Earth and on terrestrial systems. They are home to indigenous peoples. They are sources of water, of fresh water. Just think of the Amazon and think of deforestation. You don't have both. You have deforestation, you don't have the Amazon. You don't have the Paraguay River, you don't have the Parana River. Those are realities that we have to deal with every day. And if they are reduced to just carbon, well, you lose all that perspective as well.
What's now, happened to Paraguay, by the way?
Excuse me?
What has happened to Paraguay? How do you experience global warming?
Well, the main feature of global warming in Paraguay is drought and floods, basically with 1 to 2 months from each other. So you have areas of the countries of the country that are under tremendous, very severe droughts at the moment that a month ago were completely underwater. And if you take the forest away, all this pumping system that forests provide and storage for that water and purifying systems, natural ones, free of charge, just on our sovereign soil, are gone, right? So that's why it's not just carbon stocks. So I started by saying, well, saving them is the only thing we seem to agree with, especially developed countries. But we don't want to transform our forests into a trading token. Because basically they are worth much more than what they are being valued for. Monetary terms are just incapable of engulfing all those values. And if you look at the, speaking in the terms Angelica was talking, for instance, the adaptation debt we had from forests in our country will also amount to very, very close to 30-35% of our GDP. Those are the numbers we are working, we're being forced to work with at the moment. We're having people in the street, actually, because the government is not it's just not capable of providing the cash necessary for adaptation of its citizens. But every person in the street is doing it. So the principle of saving the forests, of course, is we agree with that. We are all for it. Now, the principle of transforming forests into the world's forests, into a an offset mechanism to keep on justifying this opulence Angelica was talking about in other parts of the year of the world on this minority of the population, that is unjustifiable.
We just have a few seconds, and I wanted to ask you, Angelica Navarro, do you see any possibility of a walkout here, of a collapse of the COP15?
Actually, I don't think so. I mean, we are all working very hard here because we know that the stakes are very high and we want extremely ambitious result. So I will be the first to be very saddened by such an outcome.
But we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Angelica Navarro, for joining us, as well as Miguel Lavera. They are the two climate negotiators, the chief negotiators for Bolivia and for Paraguay. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Republican Conduce, Aaron Mata, Angeli Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar. A special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Angeli Comet. Our website is democracynow.org, broadcasting live from Copenhagen.